It's so individualistic that if I talk to somebody else in my community who shares my assumptions, who went to the same school, who has the same educational background, who prays next to me in the synagogue and prays to the same God and reads the same prayer book, he don't know what I'm talking about because it's so private.
One of the consequences of Rabbi Soloveitchik and his family moving to the United States as a young man is that he found himself in a larger culture, which was not exclusively a Jewish culture. On the contrary, Judaism was a minority in America. And there would have been tremendous pressure for Rabbi Soloveitchik to think through how to be a partner with at some moments, to disengage from, to confront the other traditions that he found himself surrounded by. In this next lecture, we're going to understand Rabbi Soloveitchik's thinking about the Christian community. What did he think about the Christian community?
We understand very well that this is not his first encounter with Christians or Christianity. As a student at the University of Berlin in the philosophy department, clearly that was not a department that was populated primarily by Jews. And certainly the faculty was not populated primarily by Jews. And Rabbi Soloveitchik encountered Christian thinking, Christianity, and Christians, and was very much taken by a lot of what he read and heard. He quotes Rudolf Otto repeatedly, and others who were clearly rooted in a tradition and a religion that was different than his. And he recognized the value of what it was that they had to share. When they came to America, it was different. This is not an intellectual exercise, but this is boots on the ground. And we will encounter someone who is not just an incredible thinker in the rarefied atmosphere of the study hall or the philosophy classroom, but someone who puts his shoulder to the effort of trying to develop policy, practical policy, for the Jewish community in the United States vis-a-vis such an important issue. The perch from which he did this was he was head of what was called the Halacha Commission, the ideology and practical commission of the Rabbinical Council of America, where he set policy for the Orthodox community that was identified with the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, and was called upon in many different ways to shed light on the direction that this community should be taking, not just academically, but practically. Once again, as we saw in our last presentation, Rabbi Soloveitchik's position is thoughtful and nuanced and complex. Here again, there are many different perspectives. And the space in which I would like to anchor Rabbi Soloveitchik's position and the space that he occupied when he articulated in depth his position is post-Vatican II. Coming to the end of Vatican II, post-Vatican II, when the Catholic Church made a monumental about-face in trying to characterize its attitude towards Jews and the Jewish people. And the question arose in the Jewish community, well, given the fact that the church is now in such a different place, should we not also rethink our position? And here too, there were multiple approaches. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel was very much in the vanguard, the forefront of, let's meet them, let's engage them, let's take this moment and go with it and develop further relationships. This can only be for the benefit of the Jewish people. We will see that a relative, a very close relative of Rabbi Soloveitchik's, Rabbi Moses Feinstein, who was one of the greatest halachic arbiters and decisors of the 20th century, took an opposite position. He didn't trust them. He was skeptical. They used to think that they could force us to convert. That didn't work. So now they're going to convert us with kindness. They really don't mean it. This is a ploy. And Rabbi Soloveitchik was, once again, neither here nor there. And he charted a very interesting middle ground that we will try to understand, of allowing for dialogue, but yet limiting the scope of that dialogue. It's hard to be in the middle. And he got attacked or criticized from both ends. But he stuck to his guns and provided a policy that had practically a very significant impact for a number of decades. On October 28, 1965, a cataclysmic change was announced by the Vatican, ushering in a new era in the attitude of the Catholic Church to Jews and to Judaism. On that day, the Vatican promulgated what it called the, quote, Declaration on the Relation of the Church to Non-Christian Religions, also known as Nostra Aetate, which means in our time, translation of the Latin words with which this document begins. I want here to first place this document into a historical perspective by analyzing the classical Christian attitude towards Jews and Judaism that preceded it. And then I want to examine the debate within the Jewish community about what it should do in response to this document, with, of course, particular attention paid to the position of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. As soon as it could, as soon as it was able to, let's say third century, fourth century, certainly into the fifth century, Christianity adopted a policy of persecution of Jews. After all, the Jews were guilty of the most horrific sin, namely deicide, namely killing God. What could be worse than killing God? Jews were blamed for the crucifixion of Jesus and therefore had to be punished forever for this horrible sin. In keeping with this policy, Jews living under Christendom were repeatedly, throughout the Middle Ages, subjected to demographic dispersion, political disintegration, economic dislocation, social alienation, psychological oppression, subtle as well as crude discrimination, and, at worst, brute physical annihilation. When they had the power to do so, and they had the power to do so throughout medieval times, Christians murdered thousands upon thousands of Jews in the name of Christianity because their ancestors had committed this unpardonable crime. This was the medieval legacy of the Christian attitude to Jews and to Judaism. In October of 1958, Pope Pius XII died. He became Pope in 1939. He was the Pope during the Holocaust. And his, what shall I say, less than robust positive response in the face of the systematic extermination of the Jews by the Nazis and their supporters made him and continues to make him a controversial figure in the Jewish community. Pius XII was succeeded by Pope John XXIII, whose attitude towards Jews and Judaism was far more favorable. When he was still in seminary, he won the prize for Hebrew. He was a papal nuncio in Turkey and in Greece during the Second World War and witnessed firsthand the plight of the Jews. In that position, he helped thousands of Jews. Not sure exactly how many. I've seen a number, 25,000 Jews with clothes, with money, with papers to protect them, even counterfeit baptismal certificates. He succeeded, this individual who later became the Pope, in preventing the deportation of many Jews from Slovakia, Hungary, and Bulgaria. Another distinction, when he became the Pope, on one Saturday morning, he was in his car and he stopped, and he was in front of the synagogue in Rome, and he went out and he blessed the Jews as they were leaving services from the synagogue, the very first Pope ever to bless the Jews in this fashion. He was elected Pope on October 28, 1958, and within 3 months of the beginning of his papacy, he called for an international church council on January 25th, 1959. There had only been 20 such church councils ever in the history of the church. The last one, number 20, abruptly ended in 1870 when the Italian army marched into Vatican City and declared Rome the capital city of Italy. The one before that one, number 19, was in 1562. So you get a sense that this wasn't every Monday and Thursday. This was a big deal. John the 23rd was the first pope since the Reformation to recognize that the church needed substantial reform. Confronted by social change, advancements in science and technology, new political realities, the rise of communism, and a real fear of an almost imminent nuclear war, we're now at the end of the 50s, he felt that the church needed to engage the new world realities. This was the first church council called not to combat heresy or to marshal the forces, the power of the church against those who are hostile to it, but out of a recognition that the church internally needed to reconcile with the world as it was changing around it. Among the topics that John the 23rd wanted to address was the issue of the attitude of the church to the Jews. With the Holocaust fresh in his mind, and there's no question that the Holocaust looms very large in the background of this council, he recognized that a reordering of the long-standing millennia-old Christian relationship to the Jews needed to be done and was long overdue. After more than 3 years of preparation, the council opened on October 11th, 1962. It dealt with many issues. My focus here is on the Jews. There were many who opposed John the 23rd's initiative, rethinking Christian attitudes to Jews and to Judaism, primarily conservative Catholic theologians who fought against changing. One doesn't change. This is the way it's been. This is the way it has to be. How could you possibly tamper with something that has been so much a part of the core of Christian theology forever? And also Arab states with whom the Vatican had diplomatic relations. Pope John the 23rd died on June 3rd, 1963, in the middle of the unfolding of this council, and his successor, Paul VI, made it clear that he was going to follow the lead of his predecessor. As can be expected in the course of these couple of years, there was much bickering and politicking and a lot of disagreement. But finally, during the fourth session of the council, a council would meet for a while, stop, take a break, couple of months, come back, start again. The fourth session of the council on October 28th, 1965, 3 years after the council began, this document, once again entitled Declaration on the Relation of the Church to Non-Christian Religions, was passed by a vote of 2,312-88. Please turn to source number one. This document had five parts to it, five parts. First, the introduction. Second, it dealt with Hindus, Buddhists, and other religions. Part number three dealt with Islam and Muslims. Part number four is relevant to us with Jews, and part number five was the conclusion. I want to study with you parts of number four. Sounding the depth of the mystery which is the church, this sacred council remembers the spiritual ties which link the people of the new covenant to the stock of Abraham. So Christianity is the new covenant, right? Jews are the old covenant. We Christians are the new covenant. Jews are called, interesting, the stock of Abraham. The Church of Christ acknowledges that in God's plan of salvation, the beginning of her faith and election is to be found in the patriarchs, Moses, and the prophets. You understand very well that Christianity emerges out of Judaism. So the beginning is in Judaism. And the beginning of Judaism is in patriarchs, Moses, and the prophets. She professes that all Christ's faithful who as men of faith are sons of Abraham are included in the same patriarch's call, and that the salvation of the church is mystically prefigured in the exodus of God's chosen people from the land of bondage. One of the fundamental principles of Christianity is that if one studies what they call the Old Testament carefully, it's obvious that the Old Testament does not include references to Christianity. Christianity developed after the story told in the Old Testament concludes. But if you read it with the right eyes and you put on the right glasses, you will notice that there are embedded in parts of the Old Testament, quote, mystical prefigurations of Christianity. That if you read it right, you see that it's not obvious and it's not overt and it's not clear, because it can't be because it didn't happen yet, but prophetically embedded in the text are references to what will emerge as Christianity. And one of them is the story of the Exodus. You think that the story of the Exodus is simply about the Jews leaving Egypt. The story of the Exodus is a mystical prefiguration of Christianity leaving Judaism. We are now moving out. We are now moving to freedom. We are now emerging as our own identity, as our own religious group. And there are many, many fascinating examples of the Christian notion of mystical prefiguration. So you understand that it starts with Judaism, and then it continues on a much higher level, on a much more exalted level, to Christianity. On this account, the church cannot forget that she received the revelation of the Old Testament by way of that people, namely the Jews, with whom God in his inexpressible mercy established the ancient covenant. So we owe the Jews. We got to this through the Jews. Skip to the middle of the next column. There's a lot of theology here. I want to get to the practical. Since Christians and Jews have such a common spiritual heritage, this sacred council wishes to encourage and further mutual understanding and appreciation. This can be attained especially by way of biblical and theological inquiry and through friendly discussions. After all, we have a lot in common. After all, we're related to one another. After all, we came from you. After all, we share at least part of the same biblical divine text. So we have a lot to talk about. And the way we're going to be able to do this is by actually engaging in dialogue, engaging in conversation, respectful. You have what to say. We have what to say. We're going to study together. We're going to examine our shared, common, original heritage. Even though the Jewish authorities and those who followed their lead pressed for the death of Christ, this way they were not prepared to give up. The Jews, in fact, did press for the death of Jesus. But even though they did, and they present this as a historical fact, neither all Jews indiscriminately at that time nor Jews today can be charged with the crimes committed during his passion. Passion means roughly crucifixion, the passion of Christ, the story of the crucifixion. Even though Jews pressed for it, Now we're getting to a cataclysmically incredible conclusion. They're not responsible. You don't have to kill Jews. Not then we shouldn't have killed Jews. Never should we have killed Jews. They're not responsible, and therefore they cannot be charged with the crimes committed during his passion. It is true, something else they were not prepared to give up, that the church is the new people of God. The church is the new people of God. I mean, that's obvious. If you're a Christian, that's core and central. It's true. Yet, big circle around yet, the Jews should not be spoken of as rejected or accursed as if this followed from Holy Scripture. Consequently, all must take care lest in catechizing, the catechism is the system of Christian belief. So when one teaches it, it becomes a verb, it's catechizing, lest in catechizing or in preaching the Word of God, you have to really be careful that you should not teach lest they teach anything which is not in accord with the truth of the gospel message or in the spirit of Christ. Indeed, now comes the paragraph, absolute bombshell paragraph. The church reproves every form of persecution against whomsoever it may be directed, remembering then her common heritage with the Jews, and moved not by any political consideration, but solely by the religious motivation of Christian charity, she, the church, deplores all hatreds, persecutions, displays of anti-Semitism leveled at any time or from any source against the Jews. It is impossible to overstate the extraordinary power of these words, absolutely flying in the face of centuries, more than centuries, of total, obvious, clear, non-negotiable, simply assumed Christian theology about the Jews and the burden, the responsibility that Jews have for being complicit in the crucifixion of Jesus. When this document appeared, it was criticized for a number of reasons. There's no reference to the Holocaust in this document. It's now 1960-something, 65. Nowhere does it talk about the Holocaust. There's no reference to the State of Israel in this document. In fact, a cardinal who was in charge of shepherding this particular document through the council explicitly stated that the State of Israel is not going to be mentioned here and was not mentioned here in order to allay the fears of the Arab states. And he said, after all, it's a religious document, it's not a political document, so there's no reason really to have to mention the State of Israel. And also, there was no apology for past transgressions. We deplore, it's a terrible thing. They didn't beat their breast and they didn't say, oh my God, we sinned. What we did for the last 1700 years was unacceptable and we beg forgiveness. And so there were some who were uncomfortable with this document. Personally, I think that is an unfair critique. I think the document needs to be assessed not by the standards that you would like it to be, but compare it to what was. And there's no doubt, if one takes these words seriously, compared to what was, there are no words in English to describe how different this is from what had been existing previously in Christian attitudes towards Judaism. On the face of it, the document promised a new beginning. On the face of it, the possibility now developed of opening up a new era, an entirely new era in Jewish-Catholic relations, one marked by hope and one marked by respect. 2,000 almost years of hatred and discrimination and persecution on the part of the church directed against the Jews seemed pretty clearly to be coming to an end. A new era of religious tolerance and of ecumenicism dawned with the possibility of mutually respectful Jewish, Christian, and in this case in particular, Jewish Catholic debate and dialogue. And indeed, there were those in the Jewish community who enthusiastically hailed this document. Prominent among them was Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Rabbi Heschel was one of the leading Jewish philosophers and theologians of the 20th century. He served as a professor at the Hebrew Union College, the Reform Movement, at the Jewish Theological Seminary, the Conservative Movement. He played a very important role in representing the Jewish community in meetings and in written communications with the people in the church who were involved with this document. And he published an article in 1967 describing his position. Source number two, From Mission to Dialogue, Abraham Joshua Heschel. This is based on a talk that he delivered. This is a very important article, a very interesting article, and it's important to get a sense of the multiplicity of responses to this document. And what I want to do this unit is to set up two different polar opposite responses, and then to place the response of Rabbi Soloveitchik somewhere in the middle. So at one end, we have Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. He is very much supporting and excited about this development. The primary aim of these reflections is to inquire how a Jew out of his commitment and a Christian out of his commitment can find a religious basis for communication and cooperation on matters relevant to their moral and spiritual concern in spite of disagreement. Obviously, there are going to be disagreements, but there are areas, moral and spiritual concern, that we can actually talk to one another, areas of concern that we actually share. Skip a paragraph. We pray for all men, for the fulfillment of their needs. Our religious commitment as Jews involves concern for the physical and spiritual welfare of all men. We're not just, as Jews, concerned about Jews. We're concerned about everybody, every human being. It is our most fervent prayer that all human beings will call upon God. Next column, parochialism has become untenable. Next paragraph, the religions of the world are no more self-sufficient, no more independent, no more isolated than individuals or nations. Jews and Christians share the perils and the fears. We stand on the brink of the abyss together. Horizons are wider, dangers are greater. No religion is an island. We are all involved with one another. Spiritual betrayal on the part of one of us affects the faith of all of us. Views adopted in one community have an impact on other communities, and so on. Many pages of an argument why we must talk to one another. We're grateful for what the church did. This is amazing. And now that the church has offered us an opportunity for dialogue, we need to embrace it, we need to recognize it, and we need to welcome it with open arms. At the other end of the spectrum was Rabbi Moses Feinstein. Rabbi Moses Feinstein was one of the greatest Jews who lived in the 20th century, the most authoritative posek. Posek is a Hebrew word for decisor of Jewish law in the 20th century in the world, and a universally respected leader of the American Haredi or traditionalist community. We know about Rabbi Feinstein's position from two letters that he wrote in March of 1967. Source number three. March 1st, 1967, Rabbi Feinstein wrote a letter, which is published in his collection of responsa, multi-volume. I again repeat, he was the most respected decisor of Jewish law the 20th century, probably. He lived on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, but his impact was felt universally and worldwide. He wrote a letter to a Rabbi Bernard Lander. Rabbi Lander later went on to found Touro College, Touro University. And at that time, Rabbi Lander was a member of the Rabbinical Council of America, which is an Orthodox rabbinical organization. And in his capacity as a member and as a leader of what is known as the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, he was going to speak at an interfaith dialogue between Jews and Christians, i.e. Catholics. And he apparently, I've said this earlier, we don't have the question, but we have the answer, we have the letter back. He consulted with Rabbi Feinstein either orally or in writing. What do you think? In regard to the matter wherein you promised to attend a gathering on March 5th, 1967, this letter is written March 1st, where Catholics and Protestants will assemble together with Jews who are members of the Synagogue Council of America. The Synagogue Council of America was an umbrella organization that included the rabbinic and the synagogue organizations of the three major denominations within Judaism: Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, and Orthodox Judaism. Each one of them had a major rabbinic organization for the rabbis. Each one of them had a major synagogue organization where synagogues would sign up to be a part of. Under the auspices of the Synagogue Council of America, there were dialogues that were taking place, and here's one that's coming up on March 5th, as well as rabbinical colleagues from the Rabbinical Council of America. Even though, wrote Rabbi Feinstein, even though what you will discuss there will be non-theological in nature, and we're going to come back to the non-theological shortly. In other words, we're not going to talk about theology. This distinction will become clear as we proceed in this presentation. Even though it's non-theological, so you might think, it's not theology, so you know we can talk about it. And there's a reason why this distinction exists. Just fast forward, Rabbi Soloveitchik himself is responsible for making this distinction, as we will see, between, quote, theological and, quote, non-theological. But even though it's non-theological, it is clear and simple. It's just manifestly obvious, wrote Rabbi Feinstein, that such participation constitutes a grave violation of the prohibition against appurtenances to idolatry. It's not idolatry, but it smacks of idolatry. Now, if you want to say something is inappropriate in Jewish law, there's probably no sharper way to say it than to say it's idolatry. Idolatry is a big, massive no-no. So it's not idolatry, it's not actual idolatry, but it's sort of idolatry. It's close to idolatry. And I'll tell you why, he says. For a plague has now broken out, in many locales on account of the initiative of the new pope. Now's the time to underline if you have a pen. Whose only intent is to cause all the Jews to abandon their pure and holy faith so that they will accept Christianity. The only reason why they're doing this is because they want Jews to convert. You see, indeed, it is much more convenient to convert them in this manner than to employ the methods of hatred and murder that popes prior to him utilized. See, till now, they wanted to convert Jews by forcibly converting Jews. So they murder Jews. And they said, either you convert to Christianity or I'll kill you. So that's one way to get at least some Jews to convert to Christianity, because they don't want to be killed. All of a sudden, it dropped into the minds of the church, says Rabbi Feinstein. That's not such a good way how to do it. We actually haven't even been that successful. How many Jews at the end of the day actually converted to Christianity? Many, but should have been a lot more. We're going to figure out a new method how to convert Jews to Christianity. We're going to kill them, not kill them. We're going to kill them with kindness. We're going to be nice to them. We're going to say, come, let's talk, let's have a conversation. You'll have a cup of coffee and we'll get to know one another, and then we will influence them. For Rabbi Feinstein, he didn't buy it for a shred of a second. This is a cynical ploy on the part of the Pope and the Church, with one intention only, and that is a new way. We're figuring out a new way how to convert the Jews. Consequently, all contact and discussion with them, even on, here it is again, worldly matters, that's another way how to say non-theological, is forbidden. For the act of drawing near, that's a rabbinic principle, to draw near to idolatry, for the act of drawing near is in and of itself forbidden, even if it's not actual idolatry, but it's, you're getting close to idolatry. Conversion to Christianity is anathema, it's horrific, it's simply unacceptable. It falls under the category of the grave prohibition against rapprochement with idolatry. Next column, you see, Rabbi Lander, if you attend, first line, many people will learn from your example, and they will attend the sermons of missionaries. See, there's a direct line between this conversation and now Jews going to listen to missionaries. Why are they going to listen to missionaries? Why do missionaries want them to go? Because they want to missionize. They want to convert them to Christianity. And they will attend sermons of missionaries and the like. Similarly, you shouldn't even send a letter expressing what you might be prepared to discuss. Okay, don't show up, but send in the paper. Let somebody else read it. No, you can't do that either. For all contact with them assists them in this underlined most evil plot. Similarly, it is forbidden to participate in any way in meetings like the ones I heard they propose to hold in Boston and in Rome. Anyone who participates with them, whoever they may be, will be considered among those who entice and lead the community of Israel astray. This is in the Bible. This is a biblical prohibition. Such a person has to be radically uprooted from the Jewish world and the Jewish community. And here it is again. Catholic missionaries have labored for years to convert the Jews. Nevertheless, they succeeded only in rare instances. I think it's more than just rare instances, but not as many as they would have wanted to succeed. God forbid that it would be possible that many more Jews would convert to Christianity. So letter number one, don't you dare go. You can't go. This is awful. It's not what it looks like. Understand very well where they're coming from. It's absolutely, utterly, totally unacceptable. And don't fall into the mistake of thinking that they really mean it. The second letter that was written by Rabbi Moses Feinstein was to Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, comma, his cousin. You may remember, Unit 1, Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother was a Feinstein. Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Feinstein were cousins, were close to one another, not just cousins. In an interview that Rabbi Lichtenstein, Rabbi Soloveitchik's younger son-in-law, gave that was published recently in a very interesting volume, he told the story that after Rabbi Soloveitchik was no longer well, one day he turned to his daughter and said, I think Rabbi Feinstein died. And his daughter said to him, why do you think Rabbi Feinstein died? And Rabbi Soloveitchik responded, because the holiday just passed and he didn't call me. Rabbi Feinstein used to call Rabbi Soloveitchik every year to wish him a happy holiday. The holiday passed, no call from Rabbi Feinstein. Must be that Rabbi Feinstein passed away. This was the nature of the closeness of their relationship. To his exalted honorable one, my beloved, my friend, the great and well-known scholar, one who spreads Torah amongst many, our master, Rabbi Joseph Dov Joseph Soloveitchik. So he's writing to Rabbi Soloveitchik with a great deal of respect. The date of this letter, March 21, 1967. I am writing, wrote Rabbi Feinstein, because of my concern over those young rabbis who are trapped in the snare laid by the head of the priests in the Vatican in the name of the Ecumenical Council, whose intent is to call all the Jews, to cause all the Jews to convert to their faith. That's it. people are falling for it. Rabbis are falling for it. The cardinals and bishops are commanded by him, by the chief priest of the church, to establish connections between priests and rabbis through committees and conventions. This deed of Satan, has succeeded, as a number of rabbis have engaged in such associations on the basis of a permission that allows for interreligious dialogue on social, political, albeit not religious matters. So there is this permission granted to say, well, this we could talk about, but this, we can't talk about it. So on the basis of that, there are those who proceed and talk about the this part that it's okay to talk about, even though they're not prepared to talk about the that part that they're not permitted to talk about. Aside from the fact that every matter is one of religion, I mean, what does that mean? What does that mean, that we're going to talk about this and not about that? If you're a religious person, so you're going to talk about poverty, or you're going to talk about vouchers for private school education, whatever it is that you're going to talk about that's not God and Messiah, but you're going to talk about it as a religious person, from a religious perspective. So you can't really separate the two, and just hold that thought, because we're going to come back to this shortly. Aside from the fact that at the end of the day, the distinction doesn't really hold, as the priests have another way of viewing such matters. The priest looks at this from a religious perspective, not just from a, quote, secular perspective. And aside from the fact that their only intention is to exploit these meetings to arrive at matters of faith, the only reason they're doing it is to be able to engage in a faith conversation, because you know that the whole purpose is to convert you to that faith, to their faith. It is obvious that a prohibition against any connection with them, even, again, on ostensibly social political matters, at all times during every era. It is the more so as regard to this evil design that emanates from the head of the priests and so on. Next paragraph. There will soon be another large convention like this one in Boston. He already mentioned that in a previous letter. He alluded to the fact that there's a Boston conference coming up. Therefore, to overturn the conspiracy of the evil ones and the success of the deeds of Satan, as well as to rescue the Jewish people from apostasy, God forbid, it is my desire that Your Excellency, my cousin, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, sign the document that I have included in this letter. The document declares that there is an absolute prohibition against associating with priests in any way. One can neither speak with them on social political matters nor attend the convention that will be held in Boston. Not only that convention, anywhere, any place, any time, in this country or in Europe. One cannot in any way aid the conspiracy that the head of the priests has concocted through his ecumenicism. And I hope that the legal ruling issued by both of us will prevent any rabbi from joining. You see, because between me and you, we got them all covered. I have the traditionalist rabbis covered. They're going to listen to me. You have the modern Orthodox rabbis covered. They're going to listen to you. Between me and you, we cover virtually the totality of the American Orthodox rabbinate. You sign, I sign, same document. For sure, we're going to put an end to this. The conspiracy that the wicked ones have hatched with the ecumenical policy they pursue will be thwarted. Or if you want, write your own. Or perhaps Your Excellency wants to write a document himself. That's fine too. Just do me a favor, send me a copy, so I'll know what it is that you wrote. Now comes an important sentence for us in light of previous conversations. And I know of the trouble Your Excellency is experiencing during these days. May God have mercy. What's going on in Rabbi Soloveitchik's life on March 21st, 1967? His wife is on her deathbed. This letter was written 2 days before she died. Rabbi Soloveitchik is distraught. I read to you his expression of his feelings, standing there, helpless, running home, praying. It's huge. Even though I know, says Rabbi Feinstein, that you're preoccupied and you have other things on your mind, troubles, may God have mercy. But it is for the honor of God to stand in this great breach, and therefore I'm certain you will repress your distress and sorrow and immediately sign the document stating that it is prohibited to attend such gatherings, and you will send it back to me. Sincerely, yours, Rabbi Moses Feinstein. And we have the text of this joint document below. It is dated the fast of Esther, 2 days later, and in fact, Mrs. Soloveitchik died on the fast of Esther. It is prior to the Jewish holiday of Purim. It's a fast day. And that is the date of the document that Rabbi Feinstein wanted Rabbi Soloveitchik to sign. Rabbi Soloveitchik did not respond to Rabbi Feinstein's invitation because Rabbi Soloveitchik did not share Rabbi Feinstein's perspective. So here we have two positions. I'm trying to give you the landscape. Rabbi Heschel over here, who's totally in. Rabbi Feinstein over here, who is absolutely totally out. And we have Rabbi Soloveitchik in the middle. Already 3 years earlier, before Rabbi Feinstein sent Rabbi Soloveitchik this letter, in 1964, Rabbi Soloveitchik made known his position on Jewish-Christian dialogue in an article that he published entitled Confrontation. Part one of this article deals with a different version of the creation story from the version that he analyzed in the beginning of Lonely Man of Faith. And this has aroused a lot of interest. He's inconsistent. He's got it this way here. You remember in Lonely Man of Faith, he saw four discrepancies between the first chapter and the second chapter, and so we have Adam 1 and Adam 2 is a different perspective on the same text in this publication. Okay, he often looked at things afresh. I did not have the privilege of studying with him in Yeshiva University. I studied with him in Boston, I mentioned that already. But friends of mine who study with him in Yeshiva University told me that it would happen relatively often, that he'd spend 3.5 hours on Tuesday presenting some interpretation of a Talmudic text, and then he'd walk in on Wednesday and he would say, boys, forget about what I told you yesterday, I have a whole new take on it. He stayed up for a couple of hours and he racked his brain and dump, yesterday, we're starting again. That's not inconsistency, that is figuring it out. So if he came to one conclusion in year X and then year X plus he came to another conclusion, it's not a contradiction. He's thinking. Thank God he's thinking. We wouldn't want to just say always what we said years ago. So here we have a perfect example, a whole different approach. That's the first part of confrontation. In the second part, he directly addresses the question. It's now 1964. We are in the thick of the church council struggling to figure out, so what are we going to do about what the church is moving towards? How are we going to react? The Jewish community is giving an enormous amount of attention to this. He writes this article and he directly addresses the issue of the appropriateness of Jewish Christian dialogue. He posits four principles or four preconditions for dialogue. We're now in source number four. First, the bottom left of the first unit, it would be reasonable to state that in any confrontation, even the word confrontation is interesting. He doesn't say dialogue, he says confrontation. There is this edge that's presupposed in the word confrontation. It would be reasonable to state that in any confrontation we must insist upon four basic conditions in order to safeguard our individuality and freedom of action. First, we must state in unequivocal terms the following. We Jews are a totally independent faith community. We do not revolve as a satellite in any orbit, nor are we related to any other faith community as, quote, brethren, even though separated. We need to maintain our own identity. We're not there to simply prepare a way for the church. We're not there to be swallowed up by the church. We will see that Rabbi Soloveitchik repeatedly refers to the Jewish community as the community of the few. and refers to the Vatican, to the church, as the community of the many. The few can't be swallowed up by the many. Skip a paragraph. Therefore, any intimation, overt or covert, on the part of the, here it is, the community of the many, that it is expected of the community of the few that it shed its uniqueness and cease existing because it has fulfilled its mission by paving the way for the community of the many, must be rejected as undemocratic and contravening the very idea of religious freedom. The small community is very sensitive because, I mean, given the numbers, it's just overwhelmingly stacked in favor of the church as opposed to the Jews. So you have 3.5 Jews sitting over here, and you have 4,762 Christians sitting over there, and it's not balanced. And he's really concerned that the Jewish delegation should maintain its own identity. The small community, here he refers to it as a small community, has as much right to profess its faith in the ultimate certitude concerning the doctrinal worth of its world formula and to behold its own eschatological vision as does the community of the many. So number one is maintain your own identity. Don't just slide into and get swallowed up by the community of the many. Second, and the second is the most significant. The logos, the word, in which the multifarious religious experience is expressed, the multitude of religious experiences are expressed, does not lend itself to standardization or universalization. The language of religion is very different. Every religion has its own terminology, its own language, its own word, its own logos. It doesn't lend itself to universalization. The word of faith reflects the intimate, the private, the paradoxically inexpressible cravings. It's paradoxical because it's a word and it's inexpressible. The inexpressible cravings of the individual for and his linking up with his maker. It reflects the numinous character. Numinous means having a strong religious or spiritual identity, quality. It reflects the numinous character and the strangeness of the act of faith of a particular community, which is totally incomprehensible to the man of a different faith community. Hence, it is important that the religious or theological logos should not be employed as the medium of communication between two faith communities. You can't talk the same language when it comes to faith, whose modes of expression are as unique as their apocalyptic experiences. Therefore, the confrontation, 1964, the confrontation, again, confrontation, that's the name of the title of the article, the confrontation should occur not at a theological, but at a mundane human level. Because in theology, we don't have a shared language. In the quote, mundane human level, apparently, we do have a shared language. There, in the latter category, all of us speak the universal language of modern man. So we could talk to one another. It's logical, it makes sense that we could talk to one another. As a matter of fact, our common interests lie not in the realm of faith, but in that of the secular orders. Secular orders, mundane human level. That's where we actually share something with one another. There, in that area, we all face a powerful antagonist. All religious people face a powerful antagonist. We all have to contend with a considerable number of matters of great concern. The relationship between two communities must be outer-directed and related to the, here it is again, secular orders, with which men of faith come face to face. In the secular sphere, we may discuss positions to be taken, ideas to be evolved, plans to be formulated. In these matters, religious communities may together recommend action to be developed and may seize the initiative to be implemented by general society. However, our joint engagement in this kind of enterprise must not dull our sense of identity as a faith community. We must always remember that our singular commitment to God and our hope and indomitable will for survival are non-negotiable, non-rationalizable, and are not subject to debate and argumentation. The great encounter between God and man is a holy, personal affair, incomprehensible to the outsider. And now he says something that I frankly don't begin to understand what he's saying. Even to a brother of the same faith community. I have no idea what that means. Because what that means basically blows up the totality of Rabbi Soloveitchik's life. It's inexpressible. It's so private. Not only can I not share it with a Christian, I can't even share it with another Jew. What does that mean? What is a parent supposed to do? What is a teacher supposed to do? What is a friend? I can't. It's so individualistic that if I talk to somebody else in my community who shares my assumptions, who went to the same school, who has the same educational background, who prays next to me in the synagogue and prays to the same God and reads the same prayer book, he don't know what I'm talking about because it's so private. So I want to bracket that. Maybe at some point, to come back to that. I don't know what he means when he says, even to a brother of the same faith community. Let's leave that aside. I can't talk to Christians, to Catholics, about theology because we're talking different languages. I can't explain myself. There are no words that will be of common interest. And when that person, the Catholic, speaks to me, I won't know what he's talking about because he also has a whole set of categories, a vocabulary, logos, words that are irrepressibly private in terms of the context of his own religion. So that's number two. Number two is you have to be careful what you talk about. The word is very private. It's clearly very private in the context of theology, of faith, but in mundane human matters, in quote secular matters, in the quote secular sphere, there we do have a universal language, so there we can have a conversation. Third, we members of the community of the few should always act with tact and understanding and refrain from suggesting to the community of the many, which is both proud and prudent, changes in its ritual or emendation of its text. We shouldn't be telling them what to do. So parts of the Christian service talk about the crucifixion and talk about Jewish complicity and talk about Jewish guilt. It's part of their text. It's not our business to tell them what they should do in their own religious behavior, in their own religious belief, in their own religious articulations, in their own religious commitments. That's their business. It is inappropriate for us to stick ourselves into and make demands on them to change their own ritual and their own practice. Fourth, we certainly have not been authorized by our history, sanctified by the martyrdom of millions, to even hint to another faith community that we are mentally ready to revise historical attitudes, to trade favors pertaining to fundamental matters of faith, and to reconcile differences. Number four is we need to be authentic to our tradition. We can't make compromises. We may be tempted to make compromises. We want to be nice. They are coming to us over here. We want to meet them, and meeting them means maybe this we're going to have to rethink, and this we're going to have to rethink. Just like we can't tell them what to do, we ourselves must be firm in maintaining the values, beliefs, concepts, logos, language, ideology that is central to us. And the article ends in source number five with a statement that was adopted by the Rabbinical Council of America at its convention, summarizing the ideology of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So there are four criteria here that he lays out for dialogue. Substantial critique was leveled against this article and Rabbi Soloveitchik's position, particularly number two,
particularly the criteria or prerequisite number two. If you go back to number two, and I spent a lot of time and I read more than maybe I should have, but I wanted to make sure it was clear. Rabbi Soloveitchik distinguishes between theology and secular, between faith and mundane. Dialogue can be undertaken on moral and social issues, secular or mundane issues, but not in areas of faith, dogma, or theology. But then it would appear that he totally collapses this distinction in footnote number 8. There are two famous footnotes in the totality of Rabbi Soloveitchik's corpus. The first one is footnote number 4 in Halachic Man. That's about 5 pages long. One footnote, very important footnote. He talks about, don't think that religion is there to make you feel good, that religion is there to caress you and make you feel nice. Religion is a challenge, religion is difficult, religion is submission, religion is a struggle. Footnote 4 of Halachic Man, and the second footnote is footnote 8 in Confrontation. Let's look at the text on which this footnote is placed. He writes, I'm going to read it again, the Confrontation, end of line 4, at the top of page 24 in the article. The confrontation should occur not at a theological but at a mundane human level. There, all of us speak the universal language of modern man. There, we do have what to talk about. We do have a common language when it comes to mundane issues. As a matter of fact, our common interests lie not in the realm of faith, but in that of the secular orders. Footnote number 8. The term secular orders is used here in accordance with its popular semantics. You may remember that in previous presentations, I also was trying to grapple with the notion of secular knowledge. And I said that Rabbi Soloveitchik uses it, not because it's secular as opposed to having some kind of a religious significance, because I believe that he did feel it had a religious significance, but it's popular semantics. That's how I'm using the word secular. Now comes the sentence. For the man of faith, this term is a misnomer. God claims the whole, not a part of man. And whatever he, God, established as an order within the scheme of creation is sacred. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. If everything is sacred, then everything is sacred. There is a rabbinic phrase that is, I'll tell it to you and I'll translate it, mimun afshach. That means either way, there's a problem. Either way you see it is a problem. If everything is now sacred, so then there's no distinction between theological and secular, because secular is not secular. Secular is also sacred. Secular also has sanctity. For a man of faith, nothing is secular. Everything is sacred. So if that's the case, so what's in and what's out? By introducing this extremely important qualification in this tiny little footnote, does not Rabbi Soloveitchik collapse the entire distinction he's trying to draw in the text of the article between the realm of faith and secular? If there's no such thing as secular, then nothing can be the subject of dialogue. And if one can dialogue about these kinds of things, even though they're sacred, then why can't I dialogue about other kinds of things that are also sacred? There is here on this page a conundrum that critics of Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed to and said, therefore, it can't be that Rabbi Soloveitchik really means what he said. He's obviously aware of the fact that he just destroyed his point in the text by formulating the footnote the way he did. And therefore, his critics have suggested that the real reason Rabbi Soloveitchik was opposed to theological interfaith dialogue was for far more pragmatic reasons. Namely, he didn't really trust that there were people in the Orthodox community who could really do this well. He didn't think that his students or others in the Orthodox community would be able to acquit themselves appropriately, toe-to-toe, with Christian theologians. They just couldn't pull it off. They weren't they suggested, Rabbi Soloveitchik thought, sophisticated enough, or learned enough, or self-confident enough. That's the real reason. Not what he said, can't be what he said, because it doesn't make any sense what he said. Must be other reasons. But a student, another student of Rabbi Soloveitchik's, I mentioned his name earlier, he translated Fate and Destiny, Kol Dodi Dofek, and translated other things by a halachic man, translated Professor Lawrence Kaplan, suggested that in order to understand Rabbi Soloveitchik's position, one must also take a look at source number 6, which is a reformulation of this position. And if you analyze source number 6, and I don't want to take the time to read it carefully, but it's there for you to take a look at and to examine and to analyze, and you already understand that this is not something, you know, you're going to hang out and you take it along with your coffee and you're just going to sort of, you know, slide it under the local newspaper, and after you finish the newspaper, you'll read this, and then you'll look at a magazine. You gotta roll up your sleeves and drill into every word. And once one does that, Kaplan suggests that what Rabbi Soloveitchik is differentiating is not between the realm of faith and the realm of the secular, but between two types of religious interfaith dialogue, between religious theological dialogue that he opposed and religious humanitarian dialogue that he permitted. So I leave you with this debate, significant debate, try to understand. So what was Rabbi Soloveitchik's position? How, in fact, do you square the text with the footnote? It would appear on the same page. I mentioned earlier about inconsistencies in Rabbi Soloveitchik, so that's fine. But it's on the same page. It's a footnote on that sentence. And the footnote just said, whoops, what I just told you, forget about what I just told you. That's what it would appear, and that's what critics have argued. Kaplan has come up with another interpretation that I think has a great deal of merit. In fact, as I mentioned already in the past, Rabbi Soloveitchik himself did engage in at least one meaningful interfaith exchange. He delivered what became known as the Lonely Man of Faith, first presented as a lecture at St. John's Catholic Seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts. Criticism or not criticism, the distinction that was drawn by Rabbi Soloveitchik had enormous influence, and it governed the policy of the official Jewish group under the auspices of the Synagogue Council of America, responsible for Jewish-Christian dialogue. As long as they dialogued with Christians, they followed, all of them, the guidelines that were set by Rabbi Soloveitchik. This we can talk about, and this we're not going to talk about. In the year 2003, the Center for Christian-Jewish Learning at Boston College sponsored a conference on the soon-to-be 40th anniversary of the publication of Confrontation. And the question that was debated in 2003 was whether changes that had taken place since 1964, changes in the attitude of the church, of the Catholic Church to Jews that had taken place in the intervening four decades, should lead even those who wanted to follow Rabbi Soloveitchik's plan to say, you know what, times have changed, the church is in a different place, we need to move beyond the guidelines that Rabbi Soloveitchik had suggested. Some presenters argued that in the intervening years, the church, in fact, made a lot of, quote, progress and went even further in its move towards appreciating the Jewish community. On April 13th, 1986, Pope John Paul II went to shul. Shul means synagogue. First pope ever in the history to go into a Jewish house of worship in Rome. If you've been to Rome, you know that the synagogue, the main synagogue in Rome, is here. You cross the river, you walk 15 minutes, you make a left turn, and that's the Vatican. So it took close to 2,000 years to traverse something that in his Pope Mobile took him 2.5 minutes. But he went to shul. That's amazing. In 1994, the Vatican recognized the State of Israel. In 1998, the Vatican published a document making clear the complicity of Christian authorities during the Holocaust and explicitly calling for Christian repentance. They use the Hebrew word for repentance in the document. It's teshuvah. Teshuvah, T-E-S-H-U-V-A-H, is the Hebrew word for repentance used by the Vatican in its document, and refer to the Holocaust by the Hebrew word for the Holocaust, namely Shoah, S-H-O-A-H. So you have in that document Hebrew, and there they really did take responsibility. So given some of the cataclysmic changes that took place not only in this document but since, there were those at the 2003 Boston College Conference who said, you know what, it's time to move on. It's a new world that those strictures or prerequisites or contours that Rabbi Soloveitchik laid out limiting Jewish Catholic dialogue are no longer in place. Others were, and others are still, more cautious and maintain that no changes should in fact be implemented, and the discussion continues. In this unit, I discussed one very public issue that Rabbi Soloveitchik undertook to address and formulated a position that had a great deal of influence. Rabbi Soloveitchik also took a number of strong stands on other, more internally Jewish issues as well. And it is to some of them that I would like to draw our attention in our next and final and concluding presentation. Thank you.
What's so striking in that lecture is the extent to which he carefully considered and thought so deeply about the world beyond the Jewish community and saw opportunities to achieve a Jewish vision for society in the realms of technology and freedom and civil rights, in so many different endeavors of human achievement and human life, and saw in this Reformed Catholic Church potential allies.
Again, we have here an example of a nuance. Rabbi Soloveitchik understood very well the power of the Catholic Church. And in his formulation, he referred to them as the community of the many and referred to the Jewish community as the community of the few. It's quite logical that many is stronger than few. And at some level, profoundly, he was concerned that the many not swallow up the few, and that there remains respect of the many for the few, as there should be for the few for the many, and a space for the few, even in a world dominated by the community of the many. And so he felt the need to draw lines and to say, well, we can't do everything together because we may lose our identity in that process. So we need to draw demarcations and say, in this area, we retain our absolute independence and our absolute identity, not even prepared to engage in a serious conversation. So, for example, in the realm of theology or faith, what is God? What is reward and punishment? Why do good people suffer? Those were realms that he didn't want to go to because he wanted to keep open and keep safe a space where the Jewish community operates in and of itself and is not potentially in danger of being overwhelmed by taken over by the Catholic Church. So on the one hand, there are lines. On the other hand, for me, what is most significant is the point that you made. That is, at the end of the day, his view and his perception and his understanding of the potential of humanity, which includes the Jewish people, not only limited to the Jewish people, obviously, but includes the Jewish people and humanity, can be served and can be achieved by engaging with respect and with appreciation to fellow travelers in the worlds of the areas that you mentioned, where we can actually work together and benefit from one another. Because actually here, what unites us is much more significant than what divides us. We care about human dignity. We care about freedom. We care about the appropriate use of technology. Now, at the end of the day, it's problematic, as I pointed out, because at the end of the day, any religious person will look at anything through theological eyes. And that's the issue of footnote number 8 in this essay that has aroused a great deal of confusion and controversy. But for me, the takeaway is, on the one hand, once again, it's not everything is good and everything is bad, just like we saw in so many other areas. And second of all, this profound understanding of, awareness of, and appreciation for the role that specifically the non-Jewish culture, and specifically a non-Jewish religious culture, and specifically the Catholic Church culture and belief and space can play, and the help it could provide, and the commonalities of interest that it represents with the Jewish community and with how he understood and wanted the world to look like.